Lecture 39, Dynasty 26, the Sayyid Period.
Welcome back. Remember last time we ended with the Assyrians controlling Egypt? I want to pick it up there at that point. And what we're going to see today in Dynasty 26 is really three phases. Look for the three phases as we go. We'll see one, Egypt dominated by Assyria. Then we'll see Egypt free of Assyria. They're going to kick them out. There's good news. And then we're going to see Babylonia becoming the new threat. Now, during this dynasty, we're also going to see something that's absolutely unique. Archaizing is what the art historians call it. Archaizing is when you look back to the old days, as the good old times, and you try to make your art like the ancient art. Now, remember, Egypt had thousands of years of history up to this point. So what we're going to get in the 26th dynasty are the kings of Egypt saying to themselves, you know, we're ruling again. We're on our own. Let's go back to the good old days. And they went back to the old kingdom. Remember the time of Sneferu. And they looked at statues. And they made statues in that style. They did it so well that art historians to this day often debate whether a statue is from the 26th dynasty or from the 5th dynasty. They just don't know. And it wasn't only the art that looked back to the good old days. It was language, too. They used archaic phrases. You know, it was almost like if we were speaking in colonial, you know, jargon. These kings were, in a sense, living in the past. But let's pick it up from where we left off last time. If you'll remember, Assurbanipal had killed all the nobility of the north, with one exception. He left Necho to rule Egypt for him as a kind of vassal. So let's start with Necho. He becomes a king, calls himself king of Egypt, Necho the First, but he's really Ashurbanipal's vassal. He only lasts for 1 year, and he is succeeded by his son, Psamtek the First. What we're going to see is a nice orderly succession of son of a king becoming king, and then his son, and then his son. You'll see this stability of sorts, and then something will change. Psamtek I, king of Egypt. Now, he is told by the Assyrians to run Egypt for him. Now, the Assyrians, of course, basically want it run like a company. They want to send the money to Assyria. So, Psamtek has to really control a large country. What does he do? What everybody else does. He puts his family members in important positions. He sends his daughter Nitocris to Thebes as the divine adoratrice of Amun. We've seen that before. So while he's in the north, ruling in a city called Sais, sometimes this dynasty is called the Sayite dynasty because of that. While he's in the north, he's got his daughter in the south, well-placed in the wealthy temples. And he increases the Egyptian army in an interesting way. He takes Greek mercenaries into the army. So he's using foreigners, right? You're going to get some foreigners coming in here. During this time, by the way, the Greeks are really becoming numerous. There's a city in the delta called Naucratis. It's mainly Greek. We have an inscription from a guy, Polycarmos, obviously Greek. And he says, during the 23rd Olympiad, right? This is about that time, even a little earlier. During the 23rd Olympiad, he was visited by a merchant from Greece. Right? And he says, that merchant, when he stopped at the city, made an offering. Who was the offering to? Aphrodite. He's making an offering to a Greek goddess on Egyptian soil. This is a Greek city already. Right? We also have Jews coming into Egypt during this time. This is emigration time. We've got people coming in from all over. And they settle in the south on Elephantine Island. It's an island right by Aswan, the southern border of Egypt. Interestingly, by the way, when excavators in this century started looking at the town on Elephantina, the ancient town, they found a few fragments, just a few fragments, of papyri that had biblical names on them. Now, this, of course, sets the Egyptologists off. They're looking for more, and they practically tore the town apart and never found any more. They just found these few names. But we know that there were Jews at Elephantine this time. So we've got Greeks, we've got Jews. Egypt is the melting pot. Now, our man Psamtek I, he's built up the army a little bit, Greek mercenaries, and I think he knew what he was doing. I think he intended all along to throw out the Assyrians. Remember, his father was made vassal. Didn't mean he liked it. And he's Assurbanipal's vassal. May not like it. And fortunately for him, the Assyrians start having trouble. The Babylonians are battling them. And the Assyrians are distracted. They've got their forces elsewhere than Egypt. And our man Psamtek marches north and kicks out the Assyrians. Right? Kicks them out. So, once again, we've got Egypt free of foreign rule, right? So, the first period has ended. The Assyrian domination is over. Now we've got pure Egyptian. This is when archaizing starts. This is when they start doing the statues. You know, it's the good old days. We're Egyptian. And they go back to the Old Kingdom statues, make copies of them. They start speaking in the language of an older day. It's back to the good old days, right? Now, our man Psamtek I is succeeded by his son, Necho II. And he's a little different from Dad in that he starts to look outward from Egypt, a broader perspective. Now, remember, whenever you go back to the good old days, you think about Sneferu and what he did, right? Well, Dad starts copying the art of Sneferu's day. He's going to start copying the international trade of Sneferu's day. So he's looking north, right? He's going to do military expeditions. He's going to start trading expeditions. Things are going to start happening that haven't happened in a long time. First, he recaptures Palestine, marches north, right? It's mentioned in the Bible. He also enlists the Greeks to start a navy, right? That's really looking outward. Because remember, the Egyptians weren't good sailors. They were spoiled by the river. It was too easy with the current going one way and the winds going another. They never liked the Mediterranean. They called it the Wajwur, the Great Green, right? The Great Green. Now, he also digs a canal. It's sort of the precursor of the Suez Canal, right? From one of the branches of the Nile, he's in the delta, right to the Red Sea. All of this is looking towards trade, right? And he does well. Egypt is booming. And he's succeeded by his son, Psamtek II. Now, he campaigns in Nubia all the way to the Third Cataract. Right? It's pretty far. Remember, it's a difficult haul. You have these rocks in the Nile, and your ships either have to be guided around them by ropes. The men would stand on either side of the banks of the Nile, holding the ships with ropes, trying to guide them so they're not smashed. Right? Very difficult. Usually it takes place in summer. Right? You want it when May and June, when the Nile is low, so you can see the rocks. But it's blistering heat, 120 degrees. Very difficult. But he makes it to the Third Cataract. On his way to the cataract, right? On his way to Nubia, his army stops at Abu Simbel. Remember the great temple that Ramses the Great built? 4 67-foot-high statues? They stop there, and they carve an inscription on one of the statue's legs, right? Big Ramses looking down on him, right? And the inscription gives you an idea, I think, of how many foreigners there were in Egypt now. This is what it says. When King Psamtek came to Elephantine, this was written by those who sailed with Psamtek, son of Theocles. So there's two guys named Psamtek, you know, very common to name your kid after the pharaoh. This is a guy named Psamtek, son of Theocles. Sounds Greek to me, right? Says, those who spoke, now this is the army, those who spoke foreign languages were led by Ptasinto, the Egyptians by Amasis. So there were so many foreigners in the Egyptian army that you had to have divisions led by guys who could speak other languages, right? So Egypt is a melting pot, and it's doing all right. It's doing all right. Now, he even, Psamtek II, after he's finished with Nubia, campaigns in the north, right? Campaigns in the north, in Palestine, And it's to support the Palestinians against Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar II, right? The biblical Nebuchadnezzar. Palestine falls. Nebuchadnezzar is too tough. Good army, really powerful, numerous. And in the Bible, we are told what happens to the Israelites. It's an interesting story. Let me read to you what happens. This is what's called by the Jews the Babylonian exile. It's when they're going to be dispersed. It's when they can't stay at their temple in Jerusalem, right? Listen to this. Talking about Nebuchadnezzar. The latter carried off all the treasures of the temple of Yahweh and the treasures of the royal palace and broke up all the golden furnishings that Solomon, king of Israel, had made for the sanctuary of Yahweh, as Yahweh had foretold. He carried off all Jerusalem into exile, all the nobles, and all the nobles, thousands of those were exiled. With all of them, blacksmiths and metal workers. Only the poorest people of the country were left behind. Now, this is a crucial time for Israel. It's called the Babylonian exile. The Jews are now going to be divided into three parts. First, those that Nebuchadnezzar carried off into Babylon. Mainly nobles, blacksmiths. They're taking the literate class. They're taking the smart ones who can do things. The poorest are left behind. That's what the Bible says. So we've got a second bunch left behind, Jerusalem. But there's really a third group that isn't mentioned in the Bible. There's a third group that escapes to Egypt. So we really have three branches of Judaism. The Jews in exile, poor ones who stay behind in Jerusalem, and then those that flee into Egypt. Now remember, at Elephantine Island, there were some Jews living already, and that's where they go. So you get a large population of Jews at Elephantine. Now this creates a difficult, difficult situation for the Jews, theologically. Take the ones, for example, who are in Babylon, in captivity. Now, before, they worshipped at the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem. This was Yahweh's house. Can you worship Yahweh away from his house? Is it possible to worship him in Babylon? The answer is yes. And this is where it gets abstract. The answer is yes. Yahweh isn't a physical presence who simply exists in a building. He's everywhere. It's kind of different, isn't it, from the Yahweh that Moses encountered in the burning bush where they have a kind of conversation, you know, I'll do this, you do this. It's different, but it's necessary. Now, there's another question that the Jews start to ask here. And it's basically, why are we getting such a raw deal? We worshiped at the temple. Why are we in exile? And the answer is, it's twofold. One is, there's a winnowing. It's going to be a survival of the fittest. And only those with the strong faith, the strongest of the Jews, are going to survive. That's one answer. Right? It's a winnowing. The other is, this diaspora that you're spread all over, it's going to enable you to spread the word of Yahweh. So Judaism will be a bit broader now from the chosen people. It's a very interesting thing that happens in Judaism here. People don't realize it. But those Jews who fled to Egypt, they become perhaps the most important of the three sectors. You see, the ones in Babylon, many of them, many, centuries later, are forced to convert to Islam. They become assimilated and disappear, so to speak. Many of them. You know, but even to this day, up until fairly recently, you had very tight-knit, small Jewish clans in Iraq, in Iran. But most assimilated. So the Babylonians are small in number. Now, what about the ones left in Jerusalem? Well, you know, they're the poorest. They're the ones who are going to have the hardest time. They're the ones without the skills. They can't flee. They may be the oldest. Many of them are killed. And many eventually convert, forced by the Romans, you know, to emigrate. All kinds of things happen to them. mean, it's kind of funny, but it's really quite possible that the modern Palestinian Arabs are descendants of these Jews. Quite possible. But this becomes another small factor. But it's the ones in Elephantine Island that are left alone. They become sort of isolated, but they're not persecuted. Remember, the Egyptians are polytheists. They welcome all gods. They never said you have to choose. The Jews wouldn't have been viewed as strange because they had different gods. No, they just would have had different God. So, to some extent, many of the Jews who are in Europe today, America, are really more descended from these Egyptian Jews on Elephantine Island. Right? It's an interesting situation for the Jews during this period when they're fleeing to Egypt. To Egypt. But anyway, we have a continuation of the Egyptian culture, though. We're going back to archaizing. We're doing the good old things. And one of the things that Psalm Tech II does is he buries an Apis bull. Right? Remember, that's our sort of concept. You can almost always look to the Serapeum where the Apis bull is buried and see what kings are around. And the good news is that an Apis bull died about every 20, 30 years, so you never have too long a span. And we know we have a stela that says Psalm Tech II buried an Apis bull. So, again, keeping the tradition. He is succeeded by his son, Apries. Now, Apries makes a crucial mistake. Crucial. Fights the Syrians, does okay. But then the Libyans are being invaded. Right? Remember the Libyans? Right? We've got everybody in Egypt. But the Libyans, off to Libya, are being invaded by Greeks. Right? By Greeks. Now, think of this situation. He's got an army with lots of Greeks in it. Right? Lots of Greeks living in Egypt. Living in Egypt. Libyans are being invaded by Greeks. And he goes to help the Libyans. Now, understand, we have a tendency to think of Greece as one united country. It wasn't that way in the ancient world. You had Spartans, Athenians later, all of those people. And it was like that during this time. There were different factions of Greeks. They weren't, in any sense, united. So we got one bunch of Greeks trying to beat up on the Libyans. Apries goes to help and loses. That's his mistake. Apries loses. And then his general takes control of the country. Apries is killed, right? And his general, Amasis, now becomes king of Egypt. We have a commoner, Amasis, king of Egypt. We had a nice succession of father to son, father to son. Wonderful archaizing. It was the good old days. But Amasis takes over. Now, he seems to be an honorable man. He's a general. Takes over from Apries. And when Apries is killed, he buries Apries. Buries him. Gives him an honorable burial. Now, Amasis seems to be pro-Greek. He's trying to get rid of the Greeks at first with the Libyans. But he seems to be pro-Greek, and I think he's come to an understanding that we need these Greeks. They're numerous. They're not going to go away easily. And what he does is it tries to reconcile with the Greeks. Now, the Temple of Delphi, right, dedicated to Apollo, had burned down, right, at Delphi in Greece. He sends money and men to rebuild it. Think about that. An Egyptian king sending money and men to a foreign country to rebuild their own temple. Quite a gesture. Quite a gesture. During his time, during his reign, Naucratis, our Greek city, becomes a great Greek city. He kind of gives it to the Greeks. There's a decree. You know, this is where the Greeks should live. It's an amazing time for the Greeks. And this city becomes legendary. Naucratis is talked about by the ancient historians. Naturally, our man Herodotus talks about it. But also you get others. Strabo, a geographer. There's also Ptolemy, the geographer, who talks about it. Now, Ptolemy told us where it was. See, this great Greek city became a lost civilization. It disappeared from history. Up until 1884, It's rediscovered. And the key to rediscovering it is Ptolemy. He said where it was. Now remember that the Nile forms the delta as it goes north. And remember the fingers of your hand are like the branches of the Nile. And Ptolemy described it. He said it's to the west of this branch, and there are two branches of the Nile between it and the capital. So there was a kind of description of where Naucratis is. And our man, Flinders Petrie, remember? The one who figured out that pot shards are important. You can figure out which civilization is older than which by looking at pottery. He went in search of Naucratis in the Delta with Ptolemy the geographer as his guidebook. And he found it. Walking the Delta, where Ptolemy said it would be, he found Greek pot shards, pottery that was not native Egyptian. And he started excavating. Now, if you read the newspapers of 1884, read the London Illustrated News, right? That's the newspaper. It's this British paper that had loads of illustrations, woodcuts, wonderful, wonderful engravings. The big news was Flinders Petrie discovering a lost Greek city. That was the big news. Now, what was the city like? Well, first of all, it was ideally suited for Greeks. It's located near the water, right? Greeks are always, have always been, probably always will be, seafaring people who like to do trade, right? During inundation, the houses were on little mounds, you know, because the water of the Nile really flooded this delta. And the Greeks would get along in flat-bottom boats between town and town, trading their wares. There was also a canal that led from Naucratis to Memphis, the major city, the former capital. So they could go by this canal and do business. So this was perfect for the Greek traders. Perfect. Now, Petrie started excavating. And it was a vast city, bigger than anybody could have imagined. Perhaps even 30,000 Greeks. He found several structures enclosed by a huge wall. And when I say huge, I mean huge. It was rectangular, 850 feet by 750 feet. The walls were 40 feet high, 50 feet thick. He called it the Panhellenion. The idea was that all the Greeks could fit in it. All the Greeks. And he started excavating inside the Panhellenion. Now, interesting about the Panhellenion, think how big it is. It had only one door, easily defended. In case the Greeks were ever attacked, they could get in there, and they'd be there for a long time with this 50-foot thick wall. But inside, Petrie started excavating. And there were two major buildings inside. One was terribly destroyed, and this is a bit of a footnote to the history of archaeology. One of the things that has caused us, archaeologists, problems in excavating. Mud brick decays over centuries into nitrogen. Nitrogen-rich material. And that's a good fertilizer. And the farmers of Egypt, probably for centuries, I know certainly in the 19th century and even today, have dug out this nitrogen-rich material from the bricks. And many of the archaeological sites have been destroyed by farmers taking away the walls and spreading it on their fields as fertilizer. They're called Sebachim, the people who dig that. It's called Sebach. The material is called Sebach, and those who dig it are called Sebachim. Now, Petrie found one of these buildings that had been destroyed by the Sebachim. So very little can be told about that building. Very little. But the second building was really a puzzle to him. It was about 180 feet square. Okay. Not an amazing building. Inside it were 26 rooms, chambers. And down the middle of the chambers, right down the middle, was a hall separating the chambers on either side. The puzzle was the entrance to this building was 18 feet above ground. Right? There was no doorway at floor level. It was only 18 feet above ground. Now, question is, what was it? Petrie figured it out, all right. It was a granary. See, You didn't want your grain to be stolen easily. Somebody opening a door, grabbing a bushel, heading out. So granaries typically had the entrance high up, and you would have planking high up, say 18 feet above, going across the rooms, and you would take your bushels, baskets of grain, and you would walk around with it and dump it wherever the room was. So you would keep dumping. Now, if you wanted to steal grain, you would have to go 18 feet high, get planks up, put it up. It wasn't easy, right? So this was a granary. And think about where it was placed, inside this huge Panhellenian. These people were getting ready. If they were invaded, they could wait it out. They had grain for years, right? So Petrie figured out that this was a great Greek city. Now, he found other things, though, there. He found a scarab factory where, remember, the scarabs were little beetles. They were carved in the shape of beetles or molded in the shape of beetles as magical amulets. The scarab meant to exist, right? One of the words, cheper, meant to exist. It also meant beetle. So it was a pun, if you'll remember. And if you wore a little scarab around your neck, it meant you would exist. Now, these were very, very common amulets. They manufactured them by the thousands. Actually, even by the hundred thousands. And Petrie figured out how they were manufactured. There were molds. And the top of the beetle part would be carved in a mold, and you'd put your little ceramic paste, you know, your quartzite, in the mold. And you put a string through the thing, and when you fired it in a kiln, it got hard. You could take it out, and you had a little hole through it so you could wear it. Right? So he found these scarab manufacturers. And these were being made by the Greeks. That was a Greek industry. They were doing Egyptian scarabs, but the Greeks were traders. They would make whatever sold, right? So he found thousands and thousands of molds for scarabs, a major industry. And these Greeks would have gone all over Egypt selling them. He also found ironworks, right? So these people were manufacturing tools also of various kinds. This was an industry city where they had the distribution right there. So Petrie discovers this lost city. Right? It's an important, very important. Now, Babylon is eventually destroyed. It's destroyed. Right? So they don't have to worry about the Babylonians now, maybe. But we have a new threat, right? We're in the third phase of this dynasty. We've seen the Assyrians occupying, thrown off, right? Babylonians. Babylonians are now going to be destroyed. But there's a new threat. The Persians. Right? The Persians are coming. Now, during the reign of Amasis, this general, he's had problems with the Persians. Had problems. But they're not yet there. But when he dies, his successor, Psamtek III, inherits the Persian problem. You know, it's like in the Mel Brooks, you know, it's great to be king. Sometimes it's not so good to be king. He's king, but he's got the Persian problem. And he is defeated by the Persians. He goes to fight them at Pelusium. It's in the Delta, right? Eastern Delta. Trying to keep them out of Egypt, the Persians. A new threat. And he loses. He flees. He goes back to Memphis, hoping that there's a fortress there that will hold him. But he's captured. He becomes what I believe is the first king in the history of Egypt to be captured by foreigners and taken out of Egypt, captive. He is brought back to Susa, the Persian capital, and this dynasty ends with the Persians in control of Egypt and their king on foreign soil in chains. Next time we'll see what happens with the Persian threat.